Welcome to Sexy in Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners. However you've decided to spend the hour with us, we are very, very glad to have you. Well, Canada has been a very busy, kind of intense space. Shootings at the Parliament, the whole drama at CBC, the whole discussion about rape culture. There's been a lot going on. And for those of you who are into the whole Mercury in retrograde, I think last week there was definitely a lot of that going on, but it really raised a lot of serious topics. And as we moved closer to November, another serious topic, even though it's done in quite a fun way, where you'll see lots of people, including my friend Fiona Forbes, who's got a fake mustache on her Facebook profile right now. But you'll see a lot of people wandering around with mustaches and supporting it because of Movember. And in case you don't know what Movember is, it's where they raise money by growing a mustache and collecting donations, as men have facial hair that really rivals hockey bear, whatever it's called during the playoff seasons, which can be a very interesting experience. And I've unfortunately experienced firsthand more than once during playoff season where I've gotten totally scratched up, and it has not been a very fun particular experience with that whole stubble thing until it gets soft. There is something really nice about a nice clean-shaven man. And for those of you who are hipsters out there, I'm sorry. It's my personal opinion. Take it or leave it. But yeah, I just think it's nice to be able to see a man's face. It's a very, very sexy thing to me. So with that, there's also other things that come up because with in terms of facial hair, where they're not just growing it for fun, they're actually doing it as a way to raise money for prostate cancer. And prostate cancer usually hits a lot, most times where people start getting checks usually at the age of 50. And it can be a slower moving cancer where it takes a little bit of time depending on the case. But in regards to that, it also affects in terms of on a relational as well as sexual health. And that's one of the things we will be touching on today, because our topic tonight is about bed death, about loss of intimacy, about not being able to connect to your partner. Because I think we grow up, we wake up, and, you know, we kind of want the fairy tale in a lot of ways. It's just like we're raised on things like Cinderella. We're raised on things like Sleeping Beauty, where the prince comes in and sweeps you off your face, feet, and happily ever after, where it's like, oh, wow, it feels absolutely amazing. And then stuff happens, like illness, sometimes addiction, and many other things. And sometimes just being in a relationship in our fast-paced, crazy world where we don't feel like we're connecting as well as we used to. That sense of intimacy, that reason why we fell in love with somebody, sometimes it's really hard to remind ourselves why we're in it. And sometimes after, if we're with someone for a while and we've made the choice to have a child, that can affect as well. So there's a lot of different shifts, as well, of course, hormonal shifts as we continue to evolve. All those things can affect our relationships, but it can be challenging, and I really do. Maybe I'm a Pollyanna, but I believe that things can be fixed if you've got some support, if you're working with someone who is really good, whether it's a coach, whether it is a psychotherapist, whoever you choose to work with that is the right fit for you, you can really work through some issues. And of course, starting with yourself, but as well with your partner. So I'm really excited. I've got an amazing guest on tonight. It is her first time on. And she is the lovely, the fabulous Suzanne St. John Smith. And she has a practice in West Vancouver. She's an Adlerian trained psychotherapist, and she's got her private practice. And she works with individuals, couples, and families in the following areas: relational counseling, eating disorders, depression, stress and anxiety, grief and bereavement counseling, sexuality and sexual dysfunction, separation and divorce, anger management, midlife issues. And she's got some pretty amazing training, everything from a master's in counseling of psychology from the Adler School of Professional Psych in Chicago. And as well as that, which I just love this because I always think of relationships are about communication. One of my favorite books is The Five Love Languages by Dr. Gary Chapman. It's total weakness for me. So I just love the fact you've got a master's of communications as well at Carleton University. And I could go on because she's literally, if you want to check her out on her website, she's got quite an extensive amount of amazing things, which in case you want to check that out while we're speaking, it's St. stjohnsmith.ca. So if you want to check Suzanne out, please go do that right now. And my lovely Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Caroline. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. I'm really glad I got to meet you last night at the Vancouver Business Network event and got to chat with you and find out a little bit more.
Yeah, it was really interesting meeting you and hearing about what you've created in Beauty Night and so on. I was so impressed. And that's a website to look at as well. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I love doing all the work that I do.
Yeah, it's, you can tell.
Thank you. So in terms of for relationships, I know I kind of touched some of the stuff, but are there some more common themes that tend to come up in regards to when people come to see you because they're not happy in their relationships? Are there some things, especially with sexuality and relational health?
Well, one of the things that people tend to say when they come to me as couples is our problem is communication. And what we're doing here is to learn more communication skills and so on. And as much as I think that's, you know, right on at some level, I think the problem started long before communication became the problem. So that's what I tend to want to look at first.
Okay.
How did it get to that place where communication fell apart?
So how does... I know each case is different, but what are some key things to kind of look at?
Well, it's interesting. Relationships in the beginning, as we all know, as you just described, are all very romantic, and we just fall in love. We love being in love and so on. And
honeymoon period times 10.
Yeah, pink cloud. It's all great. Everyone's putting their best foot forward and agreeable and acquiescing to one another and so on. And then... after that happens, naturally people fall into being who they are, which is nothing wrong with that, but it becomes a shock. And then you hear people saying, one person in the couple might say, well, in the beginning you used to do X. And then the other one would say, well, yeah, but in the beginning you were used to do Y. And so what happened? Well, we weren't being real in the beginning.
So it's kind of like a bait and switch.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Feels like false advertising.
Very much so.
Yeah. And so as this false advertising seems to grow in the relationship and they realize they're not with the person they thought they were with, the challenge is to be able to allow each individual to become who they were meant to be in the first place and have the courage to be that. But that's not what most couples will do.
No.
Yeah. They will continue this kind of all acquiesce and so on, and then the resentment grows, and that's the beginning of the separation between the two of them, which can deepen and end the relationship ultimately.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So what are some steps when getting into a relationship right at the beginning? I'm guessing that one of them is probably making sure you do some self-work. But I find one of the challenges, and I've got a lot of girlfriends who describe themselves as self-help junkies, where Vancouver's full of it, both men and women. And it's great because they want to embrace. But I've also had them almost use that as a barrier to getting into a relationship.
Exactly.
Where it's like, I'm not ready yet. Mm-hmm. Where I'm just like, you evolve every day.
Well, I often say that the most spiritual and grounded, and I'm putting quotations around that for sure, people that you'll ever find are people who are single, okay? You put them in the relationship, and that's where the shit hits the fan. I hope that's okay to say that.
You can say fuck as well.
Yeah, oh, great.
It's after
good.
10 p.m.
Okay. But, you know, it's we grow in relationships. That's where our growth comes. It doesn't come from being outside of relationships. And that doesn't mean that it's wrong to be outside of a relationship, of course. But what I'm saying is I think that when we're in relationships, the other person mirrors where we need to grow, right?
Mm.
And so whatever Bob is doing that really bugs me, I need to look at that. Like, what is that for me that it really bugs me, you know? And it may be something legitimate, fine. But I think... people show each other indirectly where they need to grow. And when I'm not in a relationship, for example, I would feel, oh, this is great. I'm so together. This is great. There's no friction. I get to do what I want. Put the person in a relationship, and that's where the fur flies. And yeah, so if we can see relationships as an opportunity for our own personal growth, rather than this person now has the burden of making my life great, that's going to be the big change.
Okay.
I think that's what people fall into, unfortunately. He or she is going to fix it for me.
Wow.
And we forget about doing our own work.
That makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. One of my, I'm a book junkie. You've probably figured that out because I always reference a lot of books.
Right.
I love Dr. Harville Hendrick's work where he talks.
Therapy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just in regards to, and I don't know if that's true or not, but just the first 4 years where a lot of times we're drawn to the same people, same types of things to try and heal those pieces of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So sometimes even so somebody might be physically maybe blonde hair, blue eyes, and look, oh, that'd be kind of cool, like Hugh Jackman. And then the next person you're dating is looks like Brad Pitt.
Right, right.
Wouldn't that be cool? And maybe a Denzel Washington in there.
Yeah, for sure, Denzel Washington. Yeah. But you're listening, Denzel.
But in regards to that, after being with them for a while, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm dating the same person over and over again. No matter whatever the packaging is.
Right, because we keep picking up the same pattern because there's a healthy part of us that wants to heal the stuff that's unhealed.
So it is healthy. It's not doing the same thing over and over again and, you know, expecting a different result. Mm-hmm. So it's not the definition of insanity, which...
Well, it's not unless you... I think if you're doing it in a... Well, first of all, yes, you're right. So we get seduced into the next relationship and, oh my God, there's so many similar patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have that awareness, that's the opportunity to sit back and go, what is it I'm supposed to learn?
Mm.
Because chances are if I do the work, then I won't have to enter into this again if it's not meant to be if it's not a healthy environment anyway.
Yes.
I only have to do this time and learn what I need to learn so my picking ability changes. I become better at picking because I'm no longer coming from that needy place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need the guy or the woman who's going to fix this and make me feel whole. I keep looking for that and it doesn't happen. So what's my problem? The answer to my problem is I need to find that within me. I often tell couples that look at your partner. They are
your mirror?
Well, they're your mirror, but they're your this is your the best news, I should say, and your worst enemy. Okay, so it's your, you know, it's your worst nightmare, but it's also your greatest gift.
Okay,
because if your worst nightmare, because all this stuff is coming up, and if you see that as useful, then it can become useful.
Okay,
and so that's the greatest gift, right? So it's your worst nightmare. Oh my God, I'm having to deal with my feelings of insecurity and all whatever it might be. And so that's the worst nightmare. But the greatest gift is, okay, now what is that in me that needs to be healed that person can't heal, but they're highlighting it and I need to look at that, right?
And how do we pull the blinders off so we can really see that stuff, that meaty, juicy stuff that's there?
Well, I think that crisis is often the factor that has to come into play. I think so many people just sort of slide along in relationships and then they find themselves bang up against the barriers and they wonder how they got there. But I think the barriers themselves can be the beginning of the catalyst for change. And so for many people, unfortunately, they give up when they hit the barrier.
Yes.
And they move on and they find someone else and then there they are again in the same pattern. But if they see the barriers, a colleague of mine calls it the impasse. So they hit an impasse. And when they hit the impasse, a lot of people just say, okay, this isn't working for me. But if you move past that, then the possibility of change is just enormous. So John Gottman has often said, I hope I'm quoting him correctly, but it's many years since I've read this stat, but it says that couples come into therapy 7 years too late. And in many cases, that's true. But if they're in that impasse place in the relationship where they just, you know, they can't agree and everything is miserable and all the rest of it, and they go to therapy, say, for example, with somebody who really goes, okay, this is the impasse, this is the opportunity,
yes,
and helps guide them through that. And so you're doing individual counseling within a couple's context, and that's the beginning of great change. I've seen it happen time and again.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Powerful.
No, that sounds incredible. In this day and age, with internet dating so accessible, and just like I think back to that, like 200 years ago, even basic decisions like, what are you going to eat today? I'm going to eat swill. Right. What are you going to eat for lunch? Swill.
Right.
What am I going to eat for dinner? Swill. Right. Isn't that great? It's swell. I'm eating swill today. But in terms of that, we didn't have to make as many decisions. Mm-hmm. So we're a little bit like, just in terms of the whole flight or fight syndrome, mm-hmm. sometimes it mm-hmm. feels like there's that inside voice going, and our cortisol levels are just through the roof mm-hmm. as a society. Mm-hmm. And being able to connect with somebody and being able to maintain where and trying when things seem so accessible, where you can just go online and see if what else is out there and go mm-hmm. literally shopping.
Exactly.
Window shopping.
Right. And so it becomes a kind of fast food culture
yes.
in terms of dating, right, and relationships. Mm-hmm. So nobody's staying around long enough. You have Tinder, for example, that, you know, people are looking at who's nearby and flicking to see the faces and going, oh, that's a cute guy or that's a cute girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis on which they're making a decision to have some kind of hookup. But, you know, so it's very difficult for people to know or to be willing, even to know, I should say, even mm-hmm. how to make a commitment to a relationship because it's so fast food.
It is.
Right? So that becomes very challenging.
So what do you think we need to do as a society as we're shifting our culture in regards to, like, support our young ones who have never not had exposure to social media? This is
right.
just kind of normal for them.
Right.
Even in their gaming worlds as the young ones, mm-hmm. they're getting used to it now.
Right.
What are some things that you think that perhaps we can do just to make sure that we can continue to establish that relational piece?
Well, I think that parents play a huge role in modeling what healthy relationships can look like. So even though, I mean, my son is now 28, but he never did the online dating or anything like that. Mm. When they're young, they have so many people around them, they don't need to do that necessarily. But I think seeing, having really good communication in the home as the children grow up, then I think that sets a tone for what the expectations can be or the mm-hmm. possibilities can be in relationships once they get into them. So, you know, you can't set the clock back. We can't say get off social media, meet face-to-face. You know, they're just not going to do it. It's kind of like saying, you know, in my generation, you know, TV has wrecked the young people. You know, well, it never did. It's just kind of moving with the times and so on. So I think parents still have an ability to have an impact on their kids while they're in the informative years, and that's all we can really do.
Okay.
And take time with our kids and encourage them to step out from behind social media and meet and talk with people about stuff that's important to them, you know, which they'll learn how to do when they're at home anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Now that makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, you know, I don't want to sound like an oldie goldie, but, you know, sexuality is so changing for the young people now. They're engaging, even at the age of 13, in activities that they have no idea really what they're doing. And
yes.
it's really about, I don't want to be seen that I don't do that. You know, it's all about a popularity contest at a much higher level, high risk level.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really scary to see that going on, you know.
No, it definitely is really scary, and especially now because there is, through social media, there is that blueprint that is there where it's there forever. Where I have a friend of mine, Dave Dixon, who used to be the sex trade liaison for the Vancouver Police Department, and he used to talk about it because he worked in the downtown east side for well over 30 years and still does now, just retired from police. But what I found particularly interesting was he said that back like 30 years ago, a girl could run away from home, become a sex worker, and, you know, clean up and move on with her life where that piece was closed. Whereas now, because so much, say, sex trafficking, et cetera, it is online. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. there is that blueprint. And as Google moves forward with the facial recognition software, et cetera, it's really scary.
It is, because you can't put it in the background now. It can't, you can't shut the door on it anymore, because once it's there forever, right?
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that's scary is that the whole idea of sexuality, kids grow up, they're in, you know, young adulthood or teenagehood or young adulthood, and they have a very skewed idea of what sexuality and intimacy is all about. So when they go into relationships, they have no idea how they're supposed to manage that part of their lives. Mm-hmm. Their expectations are completely unrealistic. And who wants to do the hard work?
Yes.
You know, because again, we're kind of a fast food society. It either works or it doesn't work, mm-hmm. you know, and why stick around and go through the hard stuff and try and make something work? If it just doesn't work, it doesn't work. Period. Goodbye. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another part that's kind of scary for the young people today.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And as well, pornography is more accessible mm-hmm. than it ever has been.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A friend of mine was actually just mentioning that they had to confiscate her son's iPhone. Because he had saved in his favorites a whole bunch of porn sites where he bookmarked them.
Right. And, child porn? Or just
oh no, just pornography. Just but he's 13 years old.
Wow. Mm-hmm. See, easy access, right?
Yeah.
So accessible.
Like where some parents, and it's, you can't turn around and say, no, you can't keep your phone in the bedroom once you've allowed it.
Right.
But starting it early on.
Sure.
And just the education piece as well, which is so key.
Right. And the other thing, too, is that when you've got young people looking at pornography, they have, again, a very skewed idea of what women look like, you know? And women already in this society have a huge issue and burden that they have to carry, that they mm-hmm. have to look a certain way and so on. But God knows, now you've got to compete with what pornography, how that's portraying women and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very challenging for both the young men and young women, you know, within that kind of pornography culture.
In terms of that, I see that there's some great references for anybody who's listening as well. If they're curious about that, there is a wonderful book called Petals, and there's a film which was actually shot by filmmakers in Victoria, but it was documenting Nick Karras's work, which he used to be a commercial photographer, and his partner thought she looked ugly, quote unquote, down there. So what he did was took pictures of her.
Ah, yes.
And it was, because he's a commercial photographer, it was one of the most beautiful things. And at the end of the film, because I saw the film first, then was lucky enough to have him on the radio show,
mm-hmm.
It was literally one by one by one, where each one looks so unique and different. Mm-hmm. There was about 50 pictures,
mm-hmm.
because he started off with his girlfriend, and when she realized how pretty she was, she showed it to a friend, and then he ended up having all these women start to ask if he would take theirs. And it was beautiful, because one chunk of it, which I thought was pretty cool, was a lot of women who had dealt with physical and sexual
mm-hmm.
abuse,
mm-hmm.
where it made them feel that their vulva was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I know that labiaplasty is definitely on the uprise.
Oh, very big, very big, very scary mm-hmm. that it so is happening. And the women are young, right? I know the work you're talking about. I've seen it myself and was really impressed by that. And I think it should be almost required,
reading
for young women,
it should.
Right? Because at an early age, they can find an acceptance of their body that they don't have to wait 30 years to get, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of cultural ideal of how women's vaginas should look and vulvas should look is so skewed. And so why not share the idea that actually beauty comes in so many different
packages
and
different
and
colors,
celebrate
different
that.
Shapes.
Totally, totally. So this idea that, you know, they go and get this surgery done because they want to kind of look like,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody else, but they don't look like anybody else, really.
No.
You know, not they don't look like the average women. So, and the pain associated with that, oh my God, again, it just breaks my heart that women are feeling they have to go through this torture to be just okay.
And that is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And for anyone who's listening who is considering it. There are some wonderful plastic surgeons out there, mm-hmm. but one of the risks in terms of getting labiaplasty, hymenoplasty, which in certain communities where mm-hmm. virginity is really mm-hmm. highly prized, and believe it or not, in LA, where people were getting it basically for a 25-year anniversary present for their hubby, getting a hymenoplasty, which I wouldn't want to lose my virginity again, quite frankly.
Yeah, no, it was bad enough the first time.
Exactly.
Thank you.
But with that, it's just really, it's just in regards to anybody who's considering it, sometimes mm-hmm. there have been, and they will mention it as a side effect, where you can actually lose sensation. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. there's a fine line between, okay, I'm going to feel better because I want to like the way I look, mm-hmm. versus where it's you're going to lose sensation.
Yeah, losing sexual pleasure mm-hmm. for the rest of your life because you tried to, you know, catch up to this particular ideal. Who set the ideal anyway?
Which is probably going to change. I mean, even if mm-hmm. you look at the trends with pubic hair, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there was like 70s full-on bush.
Right.
Then there was the landing strip.
Right.
And then notes. For... Yeah, that was completely bald,
Brazilian.
Like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And now because of so many actresses putting on, I forget what they're called, but those little fake wigs that they put on.
Oh, really? I didn't know. Okay.
They do. Yeah, so hair is starting to come back.
Yeah.
And I know just in general, because I work when I'm not doing this with a lot of people in the beauty industry. Mm-hmm. So conversations happen mm-hmm. when you're doing somebody's nails.
Sure.
And that is a conversation that comes up a lot where yeah. people can't grow it back because they've been waxing for so long.
Of course.
So it doesn't grow
right.
the way it does.
Right.
So it's one of the things to be aware of if mm-hmm. anybody's listening and considering plastic surgery mm-hmm. because it might change. It's kind of like the Brooke Shield nose that was really big in the early 80s.
Right.
And not so much
not
after.
Not so much anymore, right?
We're kind of marked age.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, yes, you really wanted that.
Yeah. But anyway, I think that a lot of that stuff is really distracting from what real sexual intimacy is about anyway.
Yes.
Right? Get very busy about how does the body look? What is going, you know, do I have hair, no hair, or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Enlarged breasts, not so. Small breasts are in, larger breasts are in, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Hard to keep track. But really, it's losing touch with your individual sense of sexuality and
yes.
what that really means, right? And what it means in a coupleship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sad piece because, you know, keeping up with the trends is one thing, but where's the authenticity? What's this about? It's about I get to express myself in a very private sexual way with my partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole amazing experience in and of itself, right? So moving away from what the trends are and all the rest of it, what are the feelings that come up as I engage in that kind of committed sexual intimate experience? And do I share that with
mm-hmm.
my partner? Because that's what intimacy is about. It's got nothing to do with sexuality. It has to do with, can I have the hard conversations? Can I share what's really going on with me,
mm-hmm.
right? And people forget that that's what it's about, right? It's not about performance. And so you talked about prostate cancer and so on. And, of course, some of the side effects of the treatment, it's not the prostate cancer in and of itself, but it's the treatment
mm-hmm.
that causes, often causes, not always, but often causes, depending on the treatment itself, impotence. And so sexual dysfunction becomes part of that. And, you know, that can be, you know, a really difficult thing for couples to handle, the man in particular. But
mm-hmm.
because the man's having a hard time, their partner will have a hard time. And so it's about having the hard conversation that this is painful, this mm-hmm. is awkward for me, that I can no longer give you what I used to give you, and who am I in the absence of that? So those are the kind of conversations people have to have when they're facing that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And many don't. And because they don't and they avoid those conversations, the relationship itself starts to degrade. It starts to fall apart.
And, of course, mm-hmm. because there's that that resentment that gets built up from the caregiver
yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And as well with that, there are other ways to please too. If the partner, especially if they're dealing with impotence or mm-hmm. erectile dysfunction, mm-hmm. There are other ways that they can please their partner too.
Right. But because we're in a society that we're in, there's so much pressure, not just on women to be a certain shape and size and look, but on men. How you perform, you know,
how long you're going to last.
Yeah. And how often can you do it in a night? You know, how many erections can you have in a night? You know, so obviously for many men that changes as they get older and their expectations lower, but they still have this idea that their identity is so much tied to their sexuality and their ability to pleasure a woman. And yeah, okay, they hear, certainly, you know, the couples I've worked with, yeah, great, okay, I can pleasure my partner in other ways, but actually this is the way, and we all know it. So we're just trying to pretend that that doesn't count, but in fact it does count. And so the struggle is, it ends up being within the couple itself, but it's really within the person trying to change that definition of what is a man? What does it mean to be a man? You know, is it all about erections? For many men, it is.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult and painful process for men who are facing that.
So is it possible?
Some men, for example, excuse me for interrupting,
please,
but some men would rather live with prostate cancer than the ramifications of having treatment. Is that bizarre, really?
Wow.
That's really sad.
No, that makes perfect sense. I was actually going to give the example of, I think it's, listeners, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I want to say Jean Valjean, but I can't remember who the character Russell Crowe played in Les Miserables, where when he realizes that the character Jean Valjean is just stole the piece of bread because his sister's kid was starving and ends up becoming a thing. Prisoner, where he just sees all crime as bad. And when Jean Valjean saves his life in Les Miserables, he can't deal with the fact that Jean Valjean might actually be a really good person, so he actually has to kill himself. So I can see that, where if our belief system at our core is so solid, where we believe all we are is sexuality, yeah, I can see wanting to live with...
It's devastating. They'd rather risk their lives than to... face the possibility of losing their identity in that way. It's very sad to watch. And it's sad to watch. I wouldn't say that most men make that decision, but I have certainly seen some men make that decision. It's very sad. And of course, that's going to destroy the relationship, because the partner is going to say, what? That's more important to you than us having some longevity as a couple and having the possibility of life after this cancer. You know, sadly, some men say, no, it's not worth it. So that's not the norm, of course. The norm is that the men will seek treatment and so on, and then they face the ramifications of that. But there are many offsetting, to the treatment at least, offsetting possibilities, drug therapy, penile injections or implants and so on. There's a lot of things that are possible. And, you know, Viagra, whatever. But again, that for many of these people, it's turning sexuality into a kind of a, okay, it's a chemical process, it's some kind of fake process. And so they just don't want to engage in that at all anyway.
Yeah.
So it makes it difficult.
No, that is challenging. And I know we talked about this in our chat yesterday when we met, where I think in terms of the way, and it's changing, but it hasn't changed completely yet, but the way we teach sex ed in schools, where there still is a lot in terms of our culture where it's up to the girl to say no. And we get used to that, where guys are going to be pawing at you. You've got to be strong and say no. Even if you really want to say yes, you still say no, that whole abstinence thing. And all of a sudden your partner's not able to get it up. And taking it as a personal ego, because as a woman, where there's that core belief system on some level where it's like, I'm supposed to be desirable, and if a man really loves me, he'll want me.
Exactly. And he'll have an erection to show for it. Thank you very much. And that's another piece that is important, because A colleague of mine, Dr. David Schnarr, she wrote a book. He's written several books, actually. Mm. But the one that I work with in my job a lot is called A Passionate Marriage.
Okay.
Fabulous book. I think every couple should read this book.
I'll have to get a copy of that.
Yeah, it's just a seminal book in the area of couples and sexuality. But what he talks about is this idea of the reflected sense of self. So couples will come to one another in not just in sexual ways, but in the partnership, that you need to validate who I am. How you see me makes me feel better about myself. And so I'm dependent upon that. And this creates this kind of tenting situation where I'm leaning on you because I need you to make me feel good about myself, and you're leaning on me for the same reason. And that eventually the relationship just can't withstand all that pressure, and it collapses. And so sexuality, the presence or the absence of an erection for a woman or man, depending whoever, at some level, if they're not healed inside, is about validating them.
Wow.
And if the erection isn't there, then I'm not good enough. And you don't love me on top of that. So screw you. And what's the matter with you anyway? And instead of seeing it as that's got nothing to do with you. Frankly, probably 99% of the time has nothing to do with the woman or the man that they're with. You know, it has to do with what's going on inside of the person, you know.
So in terms of that, where they are feeling that way, and logically they're getting mad at themselves and beating themselves up because they know it's not the right thing.
Right.
But inside they still feel that.
Of course.
What's the next step to start to try and shift the logic piece?
For the person who's not getting or maintaining the erection?
For the partner.
Well, for the partner, it's really about taking responsibility for, you know, what kind of pressure am I putting on my partner to perform? I mean, performance anxiety is a huge issue for men. With women, we're lucky. We can hide. You know, nobody knows. We can fake it. Nobody would know, right? But for a man, the performance anxiety is extreme in certain cases. And so once they get a feeling that this is happening, then you can almost guarantee, we're talking outside of prostate cancer, but this is just the norm, then the pressure is so great that if the person even thinks in any way that this is going to happen tonight, then all of a sudden the erection has now come and gone, or it's not going to come at all, right? So it's almost like becomes a fear of the fear of not being able to perform. So what does the partner have to do? I think they have to stop looking in the direction of their partner from validating them.
Wow. And if the relationship was built like that tent factor, that tent's going to collapse and it has to be built back up like a phoenix.
Right. Absolutely.
Where it rises from the ashes.
And it gets built up when people take personal responsibility for their own fears, their own expectations, and the pressure they're putting on their partner to make them okay.
Wow.
You know, so we don't need saviors as partners. We need partners as partners as we save ourselves, frankly. So, yeah.
So how do we go into a relationship looking for somebody who's actually going to be a real partner as opposed to a savior? And is there anything that we should be looking for so we can tell the difference?
It's hard to know, you know.
And especially with all the hormones going crazy at the beginning, that lovely honeymoon period.
Right, we're all screwing like rabbits, right? There's no reality based on that one, that's for sure. And thank God that's a very short-term way of living because nobody could actually do anything. They can't do their jobs, they can't do anything in the beginning of a relationship. So, that's a hard question because really what you're asking is, how do I get into a relationship and have it be healthy from the moment I get into it? Well, I think if you've gone through that pattern that I talked about earlier enough, you're going to recognize certain things right away. I think before you get into the relationship, when you're not in the relationship and you've built a life for yourself and you're doing this kind of individual work and stuff for yourself, you have a great support system and friends that you do things and activities that you enjoy doing and so on, and your whole focus is not to meet your partner, it's to enjoy the things in life that you've created for yourself. And I think that, you know, the old story is that, you know, people drop everything when they meet somebody. So what's the thing to do? The thing to do is to maintain who you are. if you can maintain who you are and you see that your partner's maintaining who mm-hmm. they are, then that's, first of all, that's way more sexy. You know, yeah. because in the long run, if you have a partner who only wants to do what you want to do and they're afraid to argue with you and or you have this, you know, person who like they're non-people,
mm-hmm.
that's not sexy.
No,
what's sexy
it's not.
Is to see somebody being themselves.
Yeah.
Right?
And owning it.
And owning it and being really comfortable in their own skin. They're not looking for validation from their partner or other people necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
They are who they are and they're going out in the world in their own powerful way. That's hot. That's sexy.
Yeah.
And that can happen 30 years into a relationship,
mm.
right? So in the beginning, I think the signs are, am I hanging on to who I know myself to be? Or am I slowly but surely eroding away the life I created for myself that I used to love, and it no longer matters because I just want to be with him or her,
hmm.
you know? And that's the sign that you need to look for, I think, in a new relationship. So you don't have to go through the 10 years of, mm-hmm. you know, crappy, you know, this kind of you weren't who you were in the beginning and now you're different and I don't like you and I hate you for you know, false mm-hmm. advertising and all the rest of it. Hang on to who you are. And keep fostering that within the context of the relationship.
Okay. No, that makes sense because I was going to ask, well, we keep changing each day. So how do we keep maintaining and yet letting ourselves evolve?
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I have a blog on my website. And one of the things that I think is really important is I think couples, they forget to continue to investigate stuff that is of interest to them.
Hmm.
They become this couple, and especially when they have kids.
Yes.
You know, it's really the kids just sap everything, all their energy, and certainly their sexual desire for a lot of years anyway, because they're so damn tired they can't figure, you know, how to, they don't know what a penis is or a vagina anyway, because they're so damn tired. one of the things I wrote about, because I love TED Talks, I think TED Talks are so amazing because they have a domino effect. You mm-hmm. listen to a TED Talk. I would tell people listen to a TED Talk every day. You'll be a more interesting person if you do that because mm. not only will you find something that's of interest to you, you can share that with your partner, but chances are, and that's all great, but you listen to a TED Talk, you might read the book of the person who's talking,
mm-hmm.
and that gets you onto another book or gets you onto something else and so on. And so we're always learning and growing and pushing that envelope. If I do that, that's my responsibility as a partner in my relationship. If I do that, I bring to the party, bring to the relationship fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget to do that. And we become really boring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same old conversations that you've had for 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is. And shoot me in the head if I have to hear that one more time, right? So people stop growing. They stop challenging themselves. That's the beginning of the, you know, what you called the
bed death.
Bed death, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because sexiness begins outside the bedroom.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so if I can be an interesting, exciting person who's got some fresh air that I'm bringing into the relationship, and so is my partner, that's already sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's go in the bedroom and have some fun, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like foreplay because you fill up first.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. So
that's huge. So in terms of that, one of the other things, I'm going to go full circle and pull one more thing out. We talked about kids in regards to pornography.
Mm-hmm.
What about, because porn addiction, and I've heard this a lot from different guests, just in terms of relationships, where it keeps kicking up the dopamine levels
mm-hmm.
when people are watching sex and violence,
mm-hmm.
and then they don't find it with their partner, so they're more unlikely to want to have sex as much with their partner because they can't feel that wonderful connection.
Right. And so they get the dopamine levels. They raise them by doing this activity. But I think the thing that's really important, well, first of all, it becomes an addiction, but it can be, as we were talking yesterday,
mm-hmm.
it can be, you can trade that with alcohol, you can trade it with drugs, you can trade it with anything. They're still going tapping into that pleasure center of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But, and when they're doing it on their own, which most pornography addiction or any kind of addiction is usually, you know, self-induced and so on, and they're doing it in isolation,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking, especially pornography, in my experience, they have a level of control, you see. And by going into the bedroom with their partner, they lose a lot of control. Mm-hmm. So they'd much rather they can do this step, 1, 2, 3, 4, and they get that, you know, that high.
Yeah.
Right? But if you're in a relationship, it becomes much harder because you lose so much control. And control does not bring sexual intimacy. It does not, it's not, you just don't get it that way, right?
No.
I mean, you get it by letting go of control. And so you not only have the unrealistic expectation of what a woman or a man looks like if you're addicted to pornography, you can't relate to another human being in a sexual way, in a healthy sexual way. But you might find porn addicts saying, well, that's okay. That's fine. I don't really want to relate to anybody sexually, you know, on a one-on-one basis. I want what I want. Mm-hmm. This feels good. It's kind of like the alcoholic or the drug addict. Thanks so much. I know all about, you know, interacting and face-to-face relationships, but you know what? I get this a lot faster. So again, usually until the person hits a crisis and they realize that, you know, they need more and more of this mm-hmm. thing because we, you know, move to this place of, you know, well, yeah, you need to increase the amount of whatever it is drug you're giving to your brain, whether it's a visual or an actual drug. You know, it just, they move to a crisis where they realize their life has become completely unmanageable, and that's at the point where they start looking at where they've gone, or the relationships will fall apart. I mean, whatever the crisis might be, mm-hmm. that's the beginning of the healing and the recovery. But it takes a long time. It's very hard. Sex addiction is a tremendously difficult addiction to recover from. So that's what that we're finding now.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of sex addiction, obviously pornography would be could mm-hmm. be part of it. Mm-hmm. What other types of sex addiction are we talking? Like,
well, you're
addicted
habitually
to phone sex,
internet webcams. Webcams, prostitutes, serial affairs, voyeurism, which comes in all sorts of forms. You know, there are couples that I see where the partner might be with their partner out in public, but the other partner is just seeking for someone to look at and stare at and be obsessed by. And so they, again, the dopamine levels in the brain have gone up, this pleasure center, and so they distract themselves by, you know, real conversation or real difficulties or what it might be in the relationship, and they latch onto this sort of thing. So voyeurism is actually one of the most acidic sex addictions, forms of sex addiction in our society, and it's justified by men will be men. And so it's a lot of the stuff we see, and we allow men to do that kind of thing, and they think it's okay because isn't that what a guy does? Like, doesn't a guy just always kind of leer at women?
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, there's a fine line. Yes, men look at women, but women look at women, and women look at men too. I mean, there's no problem with that. When it becomes an obsession, that's what I'm talking about. It's very, very destructive. Because the person will just say, well, you know, hey, that's what people do. Well, it's not what people do.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's very destructive.
And in an era where now, I mean, even just today, I was actually describing Facebook stalking. And I don't mean it in the way, like literally hiding behind my car at work where they jump out at you, which, you know, is what I used to think stalking was. Now I guess it's because it's almost used mainstream in our conversations now.
Yes.
That
it's frightening.
It is.
Yeah.
It's very frightening.
Yeah. So, yeah, sex addiction is a huge problem, and it's increasing. Say, if you even look at it 20 years ago, it wasn't quite what it is today. And I think that's because of accessibility and different forms available to people in their own home and so on. I remember when I was growing up, it would be the case that, you know, the parents would look at Playboy magazine and the father would look at the Playboy magazine and they're all in the garage or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but accessibility today is just so easy.
Just to click away.
Yeah.
Even on a phone.
And so there are difficulties that people are experiencing in their own lives, and how do they deal with that? Well, I mean, it's so easy to get hooked on stuff like this to distract from what's really going on and then find themselves addicted before they know it.
Wow. In terms of addiction, dealing with being, actually, let's just get right down to the grit of it, is being able to connect to human beings. If you could wave a magic wand and be able to change how we do education in schools, What are some key things you'd like to put in to help change things?
Wow. That's a big topic. Well, first of all, I would have sex education to involve far more than just the anatomy and what goes on and how do you make babies, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would be about talking about what intimacy is really about, having the difficult conversations, even with the kids, you know, and getting them accustomed to the idea that it is way more than the physical.
Mm-hmm.
So introducing the idea that the psychological, emotional, mental, and so on, and not just what do our bodies do when the hormones start increasing, you know, when we're 13, our voices change, or, you know, our breasts grow and so on. So I think allowing kids, having a forum for kids to talk about their feelings in school, when they're in school, while they're getting this kind of sex education, I think is going to be really important because mm-hmm. it teaches them a model for talking about sexuality in a way that goes far beyond the biological.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the conversations that need to happen. Yes, they need to know what happens to their bodies, and that's great. And a lot of parents don't teach their kids that, surprisingly. But so we need the biological, but you also need the other pieces. Because
yes.
if you don't include the other pieces, then kids leave thinking, okay, this is what my body does and this is what I need and this is what happens and so on. But you know what? Even kids who are in grade 9, 10, and so on, they have fears about their own selves sexually. And they need to talk about what those are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe you don't have co-ed groups. You have, you know, they're separated and the boys talk with male counselors and so on. And females with a female counselor, and so it's safe for them to discuss this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, I think, what should happen, actually. And then when they're older, maybe have it be co-ed, maybe in grade 12, start talking openly about sexuality and the fears and concerns they may have
mm-hmm.
and experiences they may have. And I think, you know, I'm all about talking.
Yeah.
Talking about stuff. Not avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can talk, that brings the humanness and the authenticity of who we are as human beings to the table. And if you do that, if you can do that younger and younger, then mm-hmm. I think that really sets a tone for the kids as they leave school.
And it pulls away the squeamishness about
yeah.
sex, the shame, the
yeah.
stigma.
Yeah.
Because the first thought I thought of when we're talking about having it in the groups mm-hmm. is just people using that to bully,
posting
sure. that and sharing it on Facebook.
Oh, yeah,
well,
no.
you said this in group, even
right,
though
right.
The confidentiality as
right.
a group you're supposed to set up.
Right, right. So, I mean, there are challenges. I mean, this is my magic wand, and I'm not looking at all the difficulties, but I think certainly, you know, having those kind of discussions, and you're never going to be able to guard against, because even if you have segregated these
mm-hmm.
groups, you know, you're still going to have girls in the group who might kind of put something on Facebook, and the boys, you know, in their group might have someone, you know, tattling on what they had said in the group. I mean, you know, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I still think it's better to have the conversation.
No, I agree.
Right.
I agree. And especially right now, too, with sexting on the rise.
Yes.
And I haven't decided if it's one step from playing doctor, because
mm-hmm.
people used to do that and
mm-hmm.
that was just a normal piece
mm-hmm.
versus now. I know there was a case in the States where they would, you know, send a picture on Snapchat
mm-hmm.
to a boy that they thought was really cute. But there was actually, I think it was 3 or 4 Instagram accounts where all the boys in that particular county were actually posting them up.
Wow.
And when the police actually started basically investigating, some of the comments they got from the young girls were, I'm really proud of my body.
Wow.
And basically being able to let them be proud of their body, but realizing this is actually a blueprint
mm-hmm.
that can actually cost you if you're, you know, applying for
right. Because it doesn't
university.
Go away, as you said
no.
earlier. It never goes away now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like playing doctor when we did that in the kit down in the basement with, you know, our next door neighbor and so on. And, ooh, that was fun and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like there for life.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's scary. You know, the kids, really young kids, really understand that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So I guess it's a matter of educating about separating that not everything needs to be a selfie, taking
mm-hmm.
a picture of
mm-hmm.
every single thing that
mm-hmm.
you do,
mm-hmm.
and actually just enjoying the moments.
Right.
And I guess that starts with our adults. So everybody who's listening right now, I'm going to throw that out at you as a challenge. Every time you go to a restaurant, trying to actually it used to be a normal thing. And to be honest, it's one of the reasons I love going to the Jericho Tennis Club or the Yacht Club with my aunt, because they actually are not allowed to use a cell
mm-hmm.
phone there. And I realized I was totally addicted to social media at one point because I had to sneak into the bathroom to go and check my Twitter feed. And it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then that hit me where it's like, I can't even go a couple hours without checking.
Yeah, it's like a drug, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really helped being able to shift things, just having that dawning recognition. And with kids as well, where it's just like not having to be on all the time. Mm-hmm. So it comes with the examples, as you're mentioning, from the adults.
Yeah.
The mentors, the older siblings.
And the parents not literally saying, okay, phone's away. I mean, I've seen people in restaurants with their kids who are sitting there. The parents are on their phones. The kids are on their phones and nobody's talking.
Yeah.
And I go, are you kidding? How long does this last? And, yeah. And I'm sitting there as a voyeur myself watching this going, oh my God, that has got to be the next blog I write. You know. So, I mean, it's quite something. So it starts with the parents setting boundaries around that stuff and allowing kids to have a normality as it relates to real conversation, face-to-face conversation, and connecting with one another in the family.
And that makes a lot of sense in regards to those boundaries. Do you find with young families, and I'm very curious because I know a lot of Generation X's and Generation Y's have children now, with that, is it similar to the baby boomer kids? Whereas I found with baby boomer kids, and again, I'm an outsider looking in with this, but a lot of times because it was almost because they were raised by the silent generation that it was very, very specific where there were a lot of rules, et cetera. Whereas I found with boomers, sometimes they would raise their kids where they wanted to be friends with their kids.
Right.
So there wasn't those nice solid boundaries.
Exactly. And the backlash from that has been enormous because, you know, parents trying to be their kids' best friend puts them in a place where they can't set limits and boundaries for their kids because they want their kids to like them. And as we spoke about last night, you know, I think it might have been you actually or one of the other panelists who were saying that, you know, do you want them to respect you? Or do you want them to like you? And if you want your kids to like you, you're not doing your job. You're not being the best parent because our job as parents is to be the guide to help our kids. And so that means sometimes being the bad guy. And I can handle my kid not liking me because I'm doing the right thing. And I know that in the end he's going to know I did the right thing. You know, if I'm his friend, I'm not helping him get ready for the world. So, I feel very strongly about parenting.
No, it's good. So in regards to Generation X and Generation Y, have you noticed a difference or are they still trying to do the like versus the respect? And I know that's general because each parent's
different.
It is general.
It is general. And it's difficult for me to actually make a generalized comment on that. I think there is a backlash, and I think parents are seeing that. And I'm starting to hear more conversations about, you know, damn it, you know, it's not about beating the kids into submission, but it's really about having talks with them and saying this is appropriate and that's not appropriate. So I'm finding that it's not moving away from democratic parenting because I think that's really important. And it's not moving into dogmatism either. And that's kind of what my generation or before that was all about. But I think that they're seeing that, you know what? Our job is to be parents, and that means guiding our children, and children respect that. So I'm finding it moving more toward that direction, which I'm happy to see. But I certainly do my job when I talk about parenting, you know, talking about that it's important for us to pay attention to the job that we are supposed to do with our kids. You know, we had the choice, we had them, and now what?
Yes.
You know, it's our job to do the best we can for them, you know? So there we go.
Wow. Suzanne, thank you so much for being on tonight. This has been a really, you're welcome, very well-rounded conversation as well. So in terms of anyone, if you're interested in connecting with the lovely Suzanne, you can reach her through her website and find out more about her. You might have been checking it out during the show as well. And her website is stjohnsmith.ca, and saint is ST. Just so you know, and she's located in West Van. Do you do work as well via Skype in case somebody is listening?
Yes, for Canadian residents,
wonderful.
Okay. Thanks, Caroline.
You're welcome.
Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise. And up next is Vampire Ball with the amazing Pyra. So you can tune in next week at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock to have some more sexy in Van City. So with Halloween coming up, be safe. Have fun. Use safe words. And I think you know what I'm referring to. Have a good night, everyone.